time, I think we're gonna get started. My name is Wendy, I serve the village as education associate, and we're really excited to have Mark Brucker here today, sharing about a book that is coming out this year, and just kind of introducing us to his passion for how his faith intersects with his cure for the earth. So, thank you, Mark. I do want everyone to know that we are being recorded. So Mark is being recorded, and we'll have that available on the Holden Village website, but the discussion also is recorded, just so you know. Thank you for coming. And thank you, Mark. Yes, absolutely.
Very good. Well, we've been working hard today. I didn't work quite as long as all of you, but it's great to see stuff happening here. If your eyes close during the session, we'll just assume you're in deep meditation. I'm thankful for the opportunity to teach. The way I was invited, Barbara Rossing was asked to write one of the endorsements for the book that's coming out. And so she sent me the endorsement. It was very nice, very helpful. You can read it. It's on the one handout I gave you. And then she said in the same email, I'm recruiting teachers for Holden Village, and I think you really should consider doing this. So I was kind of like, we already had plans. We're going to be on the McKenzie River, in a cabin on the McKenzie River for a few days. But this invitation was one that just didn't pass up, and glad to be here. Also glad to have a crew. You may have noticed them, but we have a crew of seven from St. Andrew Lutheran Church. And they're all here, unfortunately, because I'm the presenter, they kind of had to show up.
We're going to be drawing stars.
Anyway, it's great to have them here and have the crew for this time. People ask me, when's the last time I was at Holden Village? It's been over 10 years. So it's been back when I was a pastor up in Tacoma at Trinity Lutheran there, and came for two or three of the Holden Theological Conferences, they were called. And the one I remember especially was when the late Center of Illinois, Paul Simon, was one of the speakers here. In fact, he was a speaker here, and then he did a lecture at Pacific Lutheran University later that fall, and then he died about a month after that. And so his last lecture, one of his last lectures was here at Holden, and then the very last one, the public lecture he did, was at Pacific Lutheran. A couple things I remember that he said during that, his brother helped start Bread for the World, and he said that one of the things that the brothers would say is it's very likely when you write a letter to a representative or a senator that you are saving a life. And he meant that very specifically. He said that do not underestimate the power of writing letters. Mm-hmm. The other thing he said as he was looking toward the future, he said, follow the water. And he, you know, we're dealing with energy issues, but he thought in the long run that water issues were going to be front and center. And of course, Holden Village is a place that's very aware of water. That's an ongoing thing that has to be attended to. In the introduction that was posted up there, it mentioned an article. I do have three copies of the Living Lutheran. If you didn't get the first one, was the April edition. My daughter and I put together an article on water, and we refer to Paul Simon in that. If you want to take a look at it, I'll just have three copies around for the week. And if you want to take a look and read it, and then you can, anybody else that wants to read it, that would be available for you. And it might be helpful. It's just two-page short article. In a way, it takes some of the things I'll be talking about. And you can see what we did with it in a two-page article in the Living Lutheran. The book, Coming Home to Earth, I gave you a flyer on that. The final pages come, and then the last thing you do is index it. So that's the last thing that needs to be done. And the final pages are going to be emailed to me tomorrow. So I'm up here at Holden, and I thought I wouldn't be able to get them, but I guess I could actually get them if I really want to look at them, because the wireless is here. But that's the stage it's at. Normally they wouldn't do a flyer, but I said, I'm going up to Holden Village. There's a lot of people from all over there. I think you should put something together. And so they don't have the cost yet, but they put this pre-publication flyer together. It's interesting, when you work with a publisher, they have a lot of control, and one thing they will not do is let you design the cover. Now you can give ideas, and so all I said to them is I want salmon on the front of this book, Heading for Home, and I want not just one, I want at least two, and as if you look here, I think there's three or four of them here, so that's the picture they came up with, so they found it, and I'm glad to have that, because the whole idea of heading for home the way a salmon does, you'll see today, even at the end, I'll read a new passage that reflects how that journey home of the salmon is very, very much a part of what I'll be talking about. The other thing is the audience for this book, Cascade Imprint from Whiffenstock. I could have tried to work with Fortress, but I said, I'm a pastor from Oregon, and I want Whiffenstock is in Eugene, and I wanted that Cascade Imprint on this book, and they bought it. So I'm glad to have Whiffenstock doing that and being the publisher for that book. The audience for the Cascade books needs to be a little more broad. And it's interesting that here at Holden, really this is the kind of audience I was aiming at. Motivated lay people, pastoral colleagues, maybe the kind of book that could be used for a class, a college or seminary course, first course on birth care, that kind of thing. So, and then just other people who might be interested, and even people of other faiths who may just be glad to say, oh, it's good to see that Christians are concerned about birth care. So that's the kind of audience that I was aiming at in writing this book. And somebody else asked me how to describe it. I said, well, I didn't write it for my dissertation advisors, but it is scholarly. So I said, how about describing it as scholarly preaching? So that'll be my description of the nature of the book. It should be available then, I would say, by October, I think, is when it would come out. And I just need to get to work on the index when I get back home.
Do we all get a complimentary copy?
Yeah.
No, you talk to Whiffenstock. I have no control over that. So they wouldn't be complimentary. I would have to buy them and then give them to you. But
you can do that.
You can do that with a lot of extra money you have.
Could I get your autograph after the session?
That's my wife, Donna, if you haven't figured that out. Let's go. I'd like to start with a word of prayer. Gracious God, you have created a world in which you delight. Awaken us to the wonder and beauty of all creation. Lead us to repentance for the ecological degradation that we have participated in. Inspire us to come home to earth and to care for all its inhabitants as you first cared for us. In Jesus' name, amen. First thing we have to do is actually talk to one another. I'm going to be sharing a little bit of my ecological autobiography. I do that in the introduction to the book. And what I did is I boiled it down here to two questions. I'll give you just 3, 4, 5 minutes to discuss this with another person. Was earth care a priority in the family in which you grew up? And just, was it or was it not? That's one question. And then who or what has sowed the seeds of, I call it an ecological awakening in you? So whatever concern you may have for earth care, where'd that come from? What's the roots of that? Or who was it, or what was it that may have led you to be concerned about earth care and however you conceive of that? So just go ahead, turn to a neighbor next to you and discuss that. All right, I'll call your attention back. Just want to let you, if you look on the very back page of that handout I gave you, it says ecological autobiography. This is something, if you'd like to do a little more thinking about this, it looks at your relationship to the land and to nature, something I drew from exercise in Christian environmental ethics that Jim Martin Schramm and Bob Stivers put together. Both of them have taught here at Holden Village in the past, so that's there for you, and it's something you could do with a group of your church or some place like that. This could be a very good exercise to begin looking at these kinds of issues that we'll be looking at. So that's there for your use if you'd like. So I want to tell you a little bit about my story. So when I was a young teenage boy who loved sports and school, I laid awake one night though, worrying about whether I believed in Jesus enough to get to heaven. And I was really worried about that night in particular, and it stayed with me. I came out of a Norwegian Lutheran background, northern Wisconsin, and believing in Jesus was very, very important, and that was the key to believe in Jesus to get to heaven, and I just wasn't sure I believed in Jesus enough to get to heaven. As I look back on that, in a sense, you know, the Left Behind series came out. I remember dealing with that, especially in the 90s when I was in McMinnville. and the whole idea of being raptured and leaving the earth behind. And, well, I wasn't taught that, but in a sense, the way we talked about leaving Jesus to get to heaven, I call that a milder version of left behind thinking. And my concern about it then, as I look at back at that and look at it now, is what when you if that's the heart of your faith and that's what you're really focused on, there isn't a lot of incentive in a way to worry all that much about what happens to the earth and all its inhabitants. Because the heart of the matter is you believing in Jesus enough. So in a sense, it's a more individualistic understanding of the faith. Now, to be fair to my Norwegian forebears, these were people that were good neighbors. They did their work for the most part. You could count on them when you needed them. And so these were good people, but in terms of earth care and that kind of thing, that just wasn't on the radar screen in terms of your faith. That was the key thing. It just was not the focus of that environment that I grew up in as a child. The focus then, as I say in the outline, was to focus on a better world beyond the grave. I had a grandma I loved dearly, and she had 14 operations along the way in her life. And there were some times where my dad said she would just say, oh, I just need to be done with this so I can go to be with Jesus. That was the kind of spirituality. And again, wonderful woman, took care of us very well. But in terms of her faith, that's how she viewed it. And there was not a lot of incentive then to worry about earth care and that kind of thing. Wendell Berry in The Unsettling of America talks about this. Now, he's out of a Baptist background, Kentucky, and he talked about a dull preoccupation with getting to heaven being the heart of his faith community. And he said his concern was that the way that emerged for him, it really reflected a contempt for the body. And I have a quotation from him in that introduction where he talks about his concern that kind of faith led to a kind of contempt for the body, and not just one's own body, but just bodies in general. Then Joe Sittler, Lutheran theologian, pastor and theologian, one of the first, he wrote a sermon in 1954, the 8 years before Rachel Carson wrote her Silent Spring, and it was called A Theology for Nature. And he referred to it, as I say here in the outline, the earth is not merely a negative illustration of the desirability of heaven. Yes. The earth is not just a negative illustration of the desirability of heaven. There's a danger with this kind of thinking of prematurely writing the world off. Right, writing the world off. Now, I'm recognizing here at Holden, I'm tending to be preaching to the choir here, but this, I suspect there's people here who came out of traditions where you had that kind of individualistic focus on salvation and an understanding of salvation, or at least you're aware of people that came out of that kind of tradition. Wangari Maathai is from Kenya. She also talked about her way of doing this as a song, a familiar hymn, and she said, we're not just passing through. And this is, life is not just a matter of passing through on our way to someplace better. That's not really that good. Now, at the same time I was growing up with this, there were some seeds of what I call an ecological awakening. My dad was an early proponent of what was called creation theology. He served a small church in Wisconsin from about 63 through, let's see how. Trying to remember the dates here. But anyway, he ended up becoming a Bible camp director in Wisconsin, kind of the latter part of the 60s. And then in 1970, he was called to be the camp director for Camp Hope and Lutheran Outdoor Ministries in Oregon. And so I grew up around Bible camps. That was how I grew up. And in fact, Lori, and I don't know if Peterson's still her last name, but she's Lori Pete. Was what she was called at Bible camp. She met me here and recognized she knew me when I was a little kid like this running around Bible camp at Luther Park in Wisconsin, and she was one of the camp counselors. And now I Bart Starr and Mickey Mantle were my first heroes, but Bible camp counselors were my other first heroes, because that's just, they were the cool people around the camp. And so that was part of my background too. My dad, I wrote a, and I'll talk about this a little bit, but I wrote a lecture for Pacific Lutheran, and I'll talk about that. But after my dad heard that lecture at PLU 5 years ago, he dug an outline out of his files, and it's on creation theology. And it was pretty amazing to see some of the things that he was thinking back, thinking about back in the early 70s. And I was just struck by that. So here's a guy, he was my pastor growing up, and yet he still had this strong emphasis on believing in Jesus, getting to heaven and all that. At the same time, you see the seeds of this kind of awareness of earth care and creation care and that emerging at the same time. Now, as I said, in eighth grade, we moved to Oregon, and I mentioned here the eighth grade fruit fly experiment. And this is the only experiment, science experiment, I can remember from my middle school or high school years. The only one I remember. We each got a little jar with a couple of fruit flies in there, and they started multiplying. And at first, you know, there's a few more, and a few more, and a few more. And then I remember it was just full of all these fruit flies, and the next morning I came back and they were all dead. And they had literally died in their own waste. It was my first lesson in what happens to fruit flies, at least. Now, I didn't make quick connection and tie this all in with caring for the environment and all that, but that experiment, as you can see, that stuck with me. And so there is a real concern with, will we as human beings just die in our own waste? And now all of a sudden we're actually facing a situation where that's not just something that might be in the future. That's a very real possibility for us, and something we have to be aware of. Also at that time, so this would have been 1970 when I moved out to Oregon. Tom McCall was the governor of Oregon, Republican governor of Oregon, and he had a major impact, obviously, on the state of Oregon. I mean, there was even, Oregon became noted for its environmental initiatives. And I went to the Oregon Youth Legislature in 1973. I was a junior in high school, and we had this youth legislature, and we went down to the Capitol in Salem, and there we would practice being legislators for a couple of days. It was a lot of fun. And on the second day, the youth governor that we had elected and Governor McCall came into, you know, they would do the doors, knock on the doors and the whole bit like they normally do. And they came into the house chamber there. And it was electric in that room. They were high school kids. I can't imagine high school kids being electric around the governor anymore. But at that time, he had that kind of impact on us, and we were aware enough of it that it was electric in that room when he came in. Well, McCall was known for a number of initiatives, and it wasn't just him, but when you're the governor, you get credit for things too, some that you're behind, or you're the one that you use your power in a way that draws people's attention. I've listed a number of these here. In his inaugural address in 1967, when he first came to power as governor, he connected the environment and the well-being of Oregon in a very clear and direct way in 1967. In terms of cleaning up the Willamette River, which was one of the dirtier rivers for a time in the country, not quite as bad as the one that caught fire back in Ohio, but it was bad. He was a news reporter for KGW, NBC's affiliate in Portland in 1962. He did a piece, a documentary on pollution in paradise, and I think in many ways that brought him to public awareness. And so when he got into office, he just continued that work of cleaning up the Willamette River. And at one point, literally took control of the project, which was not normal for a government to do that, but he took control of it. In terms of public access to Oregon beaches, still 80% public. Well, that started with Oswald West, the governor in 1913. But there were some loopholes because it only applied to wet sands. Well, McCall made sure it applied also to the dry sands, because there were some people trying to work around that. And so public access to Oregon beaches is a very key thing. He also introduced an 11th commandment in relation to the Willamette River called "You Shall Not Pollute." So if you want to know what the 11th commandment is, Tom McCall thought it was "You Shall Not Pollute." Bottle bill in 1971, where you have a deposit on each bottle, that's again originated in Oregon. I think 5 cents is not enough anymore. In fact, when you think of the gas you'd spend to take bottles or cans to wherever you're going, it's probably better just put them in the recycling bin in some ways. But that started again in Oregon, Tom McCall. In terms of limiting Oregon's population, Tom McCall had this campaign that said, come and visit, but don't stay. And then if you were around Oregon that time, I still remember a couple of sayings. In Oregon, we don't tan, we rust. And then the other one was, we don't pedal our bikes, we paddle them. So this is all kind of a fun campaign to deal with the whole issue of, and what Tom McCall recognized, which is true not only of Oregon, but Washington, Pacific Northwest, this is a desirable place to live. And he was truly concerned about too many people coming at one time and overrunning the state. And I can tell you, I don't know how it is up in Washington now, in the Seattle area, but in Beaverton, it just seems like we're seeing all sorts of out-of-state license plates, people coming in more so than normal. And so this, it is a desirable place to live, but his concern was, is how do we maintain the well-being of Oregon and the region at the same time as he, well, he knew that people were going to come. But that was a real effort on his part. And got national coverage, you know, that this was kind of entertaining to have a governor talking in that way. Odd Even Gasoline Rationing Plan was something that originated here in Oregon, back in Oregon in the early 70s. I was working at a gas station at that time, and I remember when it would only be open for so many hours because it was only so much gas, and that was when the oil embargo was. So that was one solution, was you could only buy if you had an odd number. You know, you buy on odd days, you could buy gas. If you had an even number, right, you could buy on an even number of days. And then he also instituted a number of conservation measures. And I think McCall was, again, way ahead of his time. You know, we're talking now about energy and renewable energy. Well, that's important. But we're going to have to continue to focus on conservation, not using as much energy. A very easy way. That's the cleanest form of energy there is, in a sense. It's just not to use some of it. So, and he implemented a number of measures in the state for the state government, asking them to turn down like thermostats, stagger work schedules, all these kinds of very practical things. This was happening. And notice we're talking about this over 40 years later, and these were the kinds of things that were being talked about at this time. And so in a sense, and this is also time 1970, would have been when Earth Day was first observed. Gaylord Nelson, the senator from Wisconsin, was behind that. So there was a lot of momentum building at that time. And in some ways, I think we maybe missed an opportunity to do some things we could have done then. But that's part of my upbringing. That's why I have a deep love of Oregon. It was at a time in my life where those kinds of things really made an impression on me. And as I look back now, I'm more aware of how the kind of impact that had on me. Maybe with all that McCall did, I think you could make a case that his signature measure or initiative was statewide land use plan, which has been, wasn't done without some controversy. But I can tell you, having lived in Pierce County, and to compare what the situation was in Pierce County, we live in Parkland, it was called, and where you have a lack of adequate planning, and compare that to the situation where we live in McMinnville, or where we live now in the Portland metro area, and where that land use planning is certainly, in my mind, has been a significant contribution in terms of maintaining the livability of Oregon. He gave a famous message, 1973, a legislative message, where he used the term grasping wastrels of the land. McCall had a way of coining a phrase, but the grasping wastrels of the land, very concerned about people who, as he said, he wasn't for no growth. He was smart enough to realize you're going to have growth, but he said there's a difference between wise growth, I would even call it responsible growth, and just this kind of, where just whatever you want to do kind of growth. And that was his concern. It actually ended up that state land use planning actually blocked a congregation at McMinnville from
purchasing 10 acres just to the west of the urban growth boundary in McMinnville. And one of the rules of the land use planning was you expand east and west, because the Willamette Valley runs north and south. And so the way you avoid the Willamette Valley from becoming one huge metropolitan area was to do expansion east and west. This piece of land was to the west, into the hills, was perfect. We went to the city council in McMinnville, made our case, and afterwards, David knew me, and his wife was a member of our congregation, just said, you know, I know you'd like to do this, but he said, we're just not going to vote for this for at least 8 to 10 years. And they did not, and so the congregation ended up yoking with the Methodist Church in McMinnville. But that would not have happened in that way in McMinnville for our that congregation without that land use planning. So in a way, it was a problem for us, and yet I think it shows how that land use planning was at work to try to have more wise growth or responsible growth. Now I left Oregon in about 75, 76, you know, to go to St. Olaf College, and then I went on to PLU, so I was really out of the state. Paul was not the governor then, but one of the last things before he died in 1982, his final battle was to stop and measure, which would have, in a sense, repealed all that land use planning. And it was it was a state initiative that the state was going to vote on, and it was going to go down, or it was going to pass. In fact, it was up by over 20 points, and Paul just had cancer, and he was not in good shape, but he went to work on that and campaigned and turned that around and managed to get that measure defeated. And so the land use plan measures held at that point. And again, there were differences on that, and there's still continuing struggles about land use planning in Oregon, but I think it's significant that we actually are struggling with it rather than just letting it happen. We really have to wrestle with it. And McCall clearly was stuck behind that. And one last thing in terms of my own journey as a young person. Graduated from high school, and four buddies, we were all in math class together, we decided to go backpacking. Eagle Creek, which is in the Columbia Gorge. We hiked up about 7 miles, wanted to do some trout fishing. And we caught fish left and right. We actually obeyed all the rules and limits and that kind of thing. But we just kept, as long as we were within the limit, we just kept catching all these fish, and then we saved them in the stream, and all of a sudden it was time to go home, and what are we going to do with all these fish? And there was no way for us to transport all those fish out of there. We ate enough, some of them, and we ended up just basically killing a bunch of trout and leaving them in the stream, you know, and we've been taken with us. And to this day, now, yes, other creatures, I'm sure, ate those fish, so they didn't go to waste. But it was just, for me, as I look back on that, that was an example of where we got caught up in doing what was fun for us to do without anything mindful of what impact we might have been having on that stream, the trout population. I actually went back there a number of years later. Maybe it's just coincidence, but the fishing just wasn't anything like it was at that time. So we may have actually permanently affected the fishing in that stream, like what we did. We had four of us being highly successful catching our limited trout and shit, and then, you know, not doing it. Then, for me, I wanted to share then one other part of my story. I'm calling this a theological breakthrough. While I was at Pacific Lutheran, took a course from a professor named David Knudsen. That's where I first was introduced to David Bonhoeffer's writings, and when I read Bonhoeffer's discussion of the resurrection in one of his letters, in a couple of his letters, in Letters and Papers from Prison, it was one of those moments where light bulbs started coming on. Bonhoeffer's key insight is the resurrection doesn't remove us from life, but he says it sends us back to life on earth in a whole new way. And he said we need to use the phrase, drink the earthly cup to the dregs. The earthly cup, life, drink it to the dregs. And he said, there's no last line of escape from a bit from earthly tasks and difficulties into the eternal. Again, very much a very different view of that idea of leaving things behind or leaving the earth behind, but actually sending us back in. And he was looking at this, in a sense, you know, we believe in Jesus as risen, But we are, for those, we're alive that our resurrection, so to speak, is yet to come. In some sense, we anticipate it because of what's happened in Jesus, but it's yet to come. So to just ignore this life, I think it would depress it. It's almost a height of ingratitude not to live the life we've been given fully and bring it to the dregs. And Bonhoeffer's writing this while he's in a Nazi prison and facing the likelihood of being killed or martyred. And so this is, these are not good conditions. I mean, in a sense, Germany is, you know, taking, things are going to hell, just to be blunt, you know, in the world. He's right in the heart of that situation. He would have known, Bonhoeffer knew about the Holocaust and all that going on. And even with all that going on, you'd say, well, this is somebody who's, man, let's leave all this behind and go to the heavenly home. And he had every reason to think in that way. And yet he writes of the resurrection as something that sends us back to life on earth in a wholly new way. To live that life that we've been given to its fullest, or as he said, to drink that earthly cup to the dregs. Now, Bonhoeffer was not one who was engaged in doing ecological ethics. You can see there's stuff to work with, and I'm trying to remember his name, but he wrote an article for the Holy Voice, and then he came to the Bonhoeffer Congress in Basel, Switzerland, where he started to, he was working with some of the insights from Bonhoeffer and how that might apply to ecology today, and that was great to see that, and I certainly used Bonhoeffer in the book. But Bonhoeffer didn't focus on that, and yet this insight into the resurrection, I think, is very helpful to us. And obviously, the crisis that Bonhoeffer was wrestling with was Nazis. I mean, that was the major thing he's facing with. And I'll talk a little more later in the week, but right now, what's the overwhelming crisis, global crisis we're dealing with? And I would suggest it does have to do with ecological concerns, global warming, those kinds of things. That's And so the key is always to look at what's going on in our time that we need to deal with. And so we can learn from somebody like Bonhoeffer to see how he dealt with the overwhelming crisis in his time, how then are we called to deal with the overwhelming crisis in our time. Then, as I mentioned, I wrote a lecture called No Salvation Apart from the Earth. It was the fifth annual Knudsen Lecture at PLU in 2010. And this was the same professor that introduced me to Bonhoeffer. When he died, I did his memorial service, but his family wanted, his wife Marilyn and their family wanted to set up a lectureship with PLU, and PLU agreed. But somehow they stipulated in there that I had to do one of the first five lectures. And so I ended up doing the fifth one. And people, some of you may be aware of the name Marcus Borg and John Dominic Crossan. Those were the two guys around me. And so here I am, this pastor from Beaverton, plugging in to do this lecture. But in a way, it worked out. If it was Earth Care, Pacific Northwest, it worked out. It worked out fine. But that's where I wrote that, and that became then the basis for me applying for a Louisville grant, a pastoral study project grant, which and I went on sabbatical. And thank you to those of you who supported that sabbatical that are here. And I was able to go and work, then did a lot of the legwork on this project. The core guiding question I work with is, I'm not a scientist per se, so I have some scientific knowledge, but I'm not a scientist. There's scientists writing all sorts of good stuff telling us what our problem is in terms of environmental concerns, ecological concerns. But I was concerned, what will motivate us to actually make the changes that are necessary? What will actually motivate us to make those radical changes in our way of life, community to care for Earth, and thereby to participate in the salvation healing of the wounded earth? And that motivational question, I think, is front and center. And I would say that even applies to the choir. Because I suspect, you know, all of us got the fields landing by automobile. And so that our way of life is so dependent on automobile and certain things like that. That's very hard for us to give up our automobiles, even those who may be very, very motivated to care for the earth and all that. It's not going to be easy to give up our way of life and make the kinds of changes that are necessary. A couple other things I'll highlight and I'll talk more about later in the week. The term contuition, good term, but it's seeing as God sees. And I really want to work with that whole notion of what does it mean to learn to see the earth and all its inhabitants as God sees them.
and then I'll lift up the notion of God for life and earth and all its inhabitants. Again, concerned about the motivational question. And basically, I argue, I don't think fear of impending ecological disaster. I don't think fear of impending ecological disaster in itself is going to be enough to motivate us. So that in itself, it might get our attention, but finally that isn't enough for us to make the kinds of changes we need to make. Then the last part there, I say, in terms of a purpose, the purpose of the book and this project is really to cultivate a deep love of Earth, and to bear witness to how deeply rooted that love is in our Judeo-Christian tradition. And that's what I'm trying to do, is to argue that this is deeply rooted in our tradition. It doesn't mean we've always done justice to it, or that we've recognized that, but that's the kind of argument I want to make. So the next three sessions, then I'll do, the next session we'll talk about grieving with Earth, the whole notion of lament and what role that might play. Larry Rasmussen is maybe a name that some of you are aware of, but he's worked on these issues for years and years. Really a leader in that in terms of our evangelical Lutheran tradition and in the Christian tradition on working on these earth care concerns. And he was talking to my associate pastor, Robin Harper, who was down in New Mexico, Ghost Ranch, where he runs something, and she said, he was very intrigued. He said, what are you doing in a parish in terms of lament? He said, you've got to give people an opportunity to lament and express sorrow and frustration, bitterness, and all that. Basically, 2 out of every 5 psalms, or 60 to 150 psalms, are lament psalms, so it's a very strong part of our tradition. So that we'll talk about how lament can be part of this process, of this journey of coming home to Earth. The third session will be on conversion to Earth, and looking at a vision of shalom or peace, and how that, and then what does it mean for us to be converted to Earth? And then the final one, it's Bill is coming home to Earth. That's the title of the last chapter, but I really put that together with the sixth chapter. But I'll talk about taking up our ecological cross and the role of sacrifice in this process, and what might that actually look like. Then the last thing I want to do, and then we'll have some time for conversation here. If you look, and I for each, there are 7 chapters, I brought them together into 4 sessions, but I try to include a selection from each chapter. That's, I can legally do that. You can whip and stock all of them to do that. So this is the final passage in chapter 1, the introduction, and I call it Swimming with the Salmon. You can follow along as I read it. In the Pacific Northwest, nothing is more iconic than the final journey of the salmon back to its place of birth. Salmon swim upstream, struggling against the current, jumping up rapids, leaping up and over falls. A salmon expends every last ounce of energy in the quest to return to its home pool. Once the salmon has laid its eggs or fertilized them, it gradually dies and floats down the river and decays on some bank or in the shallows. Even in death, it provides nutrients so that life may thrive in the watershed. Some may view the death of the salmon as tragic, but all life dies and decays. Death and decay provide fertile ground for new life. The salmon returning to its home pool gives its life fully for the purpose for which God created it. Its journey home is not tragic, it is a triumph. Coming home to Earth focuses on the journey home human beings must take. We need to return home to Earth, the place of our birth. It will not be an easy trip. Changing our way of life, so crucial to this journey, will be a challenge. We'll have to expend every last ounce of energy we can muster, and our homing instincts are not as finely tuned as the salmon's. But make no mistake, the well-being of the whole Earth community in present and future generations depends on us making this trek. In coming home to Earth, we'll have given our lives fully for the purpose for which God created us. And just a side note, somewhere along the way, I had a professor, and I can't remember which one it was, because I would have given the professor credit, but gave a definition of holy that I'd never heard. He said, holy is when you are doing exactly what you were made to do, or you're fitted for a purpose. So even a pen is holy if I use it to write with, because that's the purpose for which it was made. If I use it to, you know, stab somebody with, then it's unholy, because that's not what it was made to use. And so what does it mean for a human being to be holy? It would be to fulfill the purpose for which we were created. And when we're not doing that, then that's, in a sense, when unholiness enters in. All right, we got a little time here. I want to open it up. Comments, questions? Anything that you're wondering about after that? You want to have. Ben?
What's the purpose of lament?
I think we got
to earth, you know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think if our hearts are not somehow touched by what's happening to the earth, and that's where lament comes in, where you get to touch your feelings and what your actual feelings about it, I think it's going to be hard for us to do the journey. I actually think it's crucial to connect with it. I was struck. Chuck showed us that slideshow with the fires here. Now, part of this may be our oldest son was a wildland firefighter, and I'd never, you know, talked to them about stuff, but I'd never really actually seen pictures of him fighting fires, but a lot of those guys looked like our son. So there may have been, part of that may have been what was going on, but I was also feeling what it was like to be, especially the five people that were here with the fires there. And there's a sense that this is your home. Holden Village is a home place, big time, for people who have been here. And so what's it like to feel that? What motivates you to do what they did for the sake of, you know, they, you know, their lives are on the line. I know they were being cautious, but they didn't have to come back in here. So they could have just let it be, you know, and nobody would have blamed them, I don't think, if they'd have just let it be at that point. You know, they've done everything they can. You evacuate for their safety and let it be. But it's that kind of, you know, but their hearts were touched. There would have been a lot of grieving and lamenting was going on while those fires were going for a whole village across the country. And so I suspect that lament was even part of a lot of these evening prayer services that were going on across the country. So that's one example.
A line from a Joni Mitchell song comes to mind, and this is part of my growing up, you know, college, I guess. You take paradise and you put up a parking lot. So she was, you pay for it. That's right. And so that was kind of a lament. There's more to that song. It's also about relationships and everything. Yeah. But that was an awareness of, you know, my late high school, early college, where, you know, sort of this early-ish hippie era, and where we had some romantic notions from Wordsworth and whatnot about the beauty of God's creation, all that stuff, you know, and to be awakened to that. And I was thinking, though, that, you know, I grew up in all sort of pious family. We were of the Danish variety, sober.
Were you the sad names?
Sad. But what, there was something, I think, that even though we didn't know it had to do with earth ecology stuff, that we were aware of, and that was we needed to be frugal. We were raised to be frugal and care for things, our food and stuff around us, you know, because it didn't come easy. So you can't take it for granted. You can't just use willy-nilly the materials of this life. You have to mend them and all that kind of stuff. And I think that maybe was, for some of us, you know, a step toward understanding the giftedness of creation, does not take it for granted. So, you know, it comes at a price, kind of.
It's part of 88 to 92, pastor of a little church in Illinois, about 10 miles from Ronald Reagan's hometown of Dixon. And patriarch and matriarch were they were conservative German Lutherans, is what they were. But Alice Schaefer, she was recycling and using everything long before anybody started talking about recycling and all that. That's just what she did. And she was a child of the Depression, too, so that was part of that. But, so I don't think that for her, the idea of recycling would have been easy. You know, maybe we're not around when that probably started, and that it was just being, you know, starting to get talked about it.
I think there's another thing, because my folks, they started their family right after the war. So they had seen terrible stuff that my father was on Pacific. And so there was like a dedication to make good, to do holy things, you know, to raise up good society.
I do think that the way the nation responded to World War II and the war effort and the sacrifices that were made in terms, and my dad talks about remembering as a kid the rationing they had to do on the farm. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of effort that I think it's going to take to address what we're talking about. And you had the Paris Climate Accord, so you get the nations talking about what they need to do, but it's going to take that kind of all hands on deck type of effort, I think, to really address this if we're going to get to something that's sustainable for the long haul.
We no longer sacrifice anymore. That's fascinating.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tom.
So, I mean, this may be jumping ahead, but I would say the antithesis of this is consumerism. And that's an American creation. How do you counter that? Because that's really what you're saying. There are people raised that way without even thinking about it. So it's, in a sense, it's natural for us to do that. Yeah. And we came through that in the 70s and became a social value. For a brief time, and now we've gone back. It's totally been ported by consumers. So unless you face that and basically destroy that, how do you get back to that?
You said jumping in. So the last session, that will be part of it. We talk about taking up our ecological cross, and I'll talk about our love affair with the automobile is one thing, and I'll talk about our consumption and consumerism is one of the things I'll talk about. It's hard. I joke, but I'm not joking. You know, I'm a big baseball fan, and you know, it used to be that baseball was America's pastime, and now I joke that America's pastime is shopping. That's good. And I'm really not joking all that much. It really is kind of, and it's easy to get caught up in that. I don't like to shop a lot, but I can do it. You know, you can just you get caught up with buying the next car or buying whatever, something new. And I think we're dealing with some of our. I'm not a psychologist, so I gotta be careful here, but you know, we deal with pain in various ways, and I think shopping is actually one way we deal with pain and things that we're struggling with. When you hear and then that.
But two really brief things, but we were talking about our families, and did people have awareness of recycling and the environment, or did, like for my family, we reused everything and we made a scramble of all of the leftovers from the week's, you know, food and meals because we were, I think it was because my parents, you know, grew up in pretty impoverished circumstances, so we were just, that was a value. We used everything and we didn't throw much away, but I don't think it was an awareness of the earth. Do you know what I'm saying? So
yeah,
I'm curious what you think about that.
Yeah, how that would connect with the overall.
Right, I think it was survival in some ways. And then the lament piece, I think we have a 19-year-old daughter, and I just don't think she grieves sort of the way of the world. I think this is what, so I don't, is there a purpose of lament, or is lament just what comes out of a recognition of how far we are from where God desires us to be, when you think of the Psalms, of a grieving of our sin and how it separates us from God.
And I'll deal with this in the next session. I do think being aware, I mean, part of our Lutheran tradition is to be honest about our sin. And so we'll talk, so I'll actually use the term, it's not something I came up with, Bartholomew, the Greek patriarch of the Eastern Church, talks about ecological sin, and with no uncertainty what we're doing. But I think being honest about who we are and where we are is very much a part of our Lutheran tradition, I would argue. So we'll see. We'll present it and see how it comes across.
Yeah, look forward to that.
Interesting experience I had. I was at confirmation camp last week. Had six kids, one going into ninth grade, one going to sixth, three seventh graders, so you get the idea. That age group. We were doing something on parables, we were doing on the parable of the talents. And I think I had one question I kind of plugged into the end. How do you think we as a society are doing in terms of our stewardship or something like that. And I just ask this question, usually get those sort of answers. All of a sudden, they're off and running. All six of them are arguing. I was kind of watching this almost, and they're going back and forth and arguing. And one girl says, "We got to go with nuclear energy." And then, no, and they're another argument. And so these were that age group, and I was amazed how engaged they were. In fact, they were kind of, they go along and they're very cooperative kids, but they're not usually super engaged, you know, with some of the stuff I do. They were dialed in on that issue, and it was an encouraging moment for me to see that age group of kids could be that engaged, discussed, and it went on for 15 minutes. I had to shut it down. I usually don't have to shut down discussion in my confirmation classes.
But you asked the question of how do we get people to address the problem, and I can think two ways. One is by example, because people just naturally copy. That's all we do, really. And we think we come up with new things, but basically we're copying things that work. And the other is, and forgive my ignorance, but we listen to both sides of this issue in different places. And I really don't think there's any way that I can actually come to a definitive answer for myself. What should I really be doing? I think it's faith. I think you have to just say, this looks like it, the way to go, and have faith that you're doing the right thing.
It's interesting. We'll do one more comment here. I'll respond to that.
Especially on such complex questions. You talk about the argument about nuclear energy. These things are so complex that most of us really cannot sit down and list the things that are deficits and the things that are good indicators to go for this. And I think you're right. I think the only thing we can do is decide today that I can choose to do this rather than that. And there's a good argument for turning off the lights. There's a good argument, and that's, we know now that most of our lights don't in fact consume a very large part of the energy use for most residents. Is you've got to go for the air conditioner or the water heater. Those are the big things. Should you put in a solar type of water heater or something like that? Those are things we can consider. What is that? Learn how to figure out what's the most efficient. If you're going to replace something like a water heater, get good information to decide what's the best one to do.
And we'll talk more about this as we go along, but it's interesting. The last comment I'll make is going back to Bonhoeffer's situation. The guy gets involved in it. He's desperate. How do I respond to what's going on here in Germany? And one of the most difficult things was just the lack of response from people of faith. And if you're not willing, and Bonhoeffer wasn't absolutely sure he was doing the right thing. He could give an account of why he got involved in a conspiracy to assassinate Adolf Hitler, but there was no precedent for that. Pastors don't do things like that. And it doesn't matter who the head of state is. And he was charged with treason, and the charge was removed 10, 15 years ago, so it lasted for over 50 years. And he should have been. He did commit treason. You try to assassinate the head of state, that's treason. And so they should have left the charge standing. But my point is, it really does reach a point. We can't just, if we wait for absolute clarity, we won't do anything. And so part of our job as people of faith is, with a limited point of view, is to respond and act. Doing nothing, which was probably, the church of, to a great extent, Nazi Germany at times was silent, and I'm not throwing stones. If I'm a pastor in there, I'm going to lose my job. If I challenge them, I've got six kids, I'm going to think twice about challenging the powers that be, because you really would get thrown in prison. So I'm not throwing stones, but I'm saying the church at that point could not find its way, and finally Bonhoeffer does something that was outside the parameters of the church. You don't announce to the church that I'm going to try to assassinate the head of state. In our situation, is it possible for people of faith, working with others who are concerned about it, to come together and take action as best we can based on the knowledge we have? We certainly need to pay attention to experts in all of this who have that kind of knowledge. But doing nothing, you know, I'm hoping our 6th, 7th, 8th, and 9th graders at St. Andrew will be in a situation where they still have to worry about this problem 50 years from now. I hope there'll be something to worry about for them. And the history books, baby boomers, we're not going to come off very well in the history books, I don't think.
Well, we've been trying to make our kids' lives easier so that they don't have to go through it like you were saying. You know, and that's been a big mistake.
Yeah. All right, I'm gonna call a halt here because I know we need a break, and then I think the next session starts in
4:15.
All right, thank you very much.